testing. Many Madhu Krishnas believe that Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, he was God.
Yes.
But if you read the Bible, there is not a single unequivocal statement, not a single unambiguous statement in the complete Bible where Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, himself says that I am God, or where he says worship me.
There is no other name.
About this business of every knee shall bow. The question, Paul, well, look, Paul, what about this business here now? It says here that every knee shall bow to God. And you're saying here to the Philippians that at the name of Jesus every knee shall bow. So Paul assures, he says, look, don't get upset. That was just something for them. And I was just fooling around with those Philippians.
Jesus, that name, Jehovah, saves, O seed of Abraham.
Because Jesus said it in so many ways that he's not God, you just want to stick it to him no matter what.
By the blood of his cross he has laid salvation's perfect plan.
I said, you're not reading your Bible. You don't read your Bible properly. You know, God has got sons by the tons in the Bible. By the tons. You know, tons, the old measurement of weighing things. Tons.
There is no other name.
And now, coming to you live from our underground bunker deep beneath the madrasa where Ergun Kanner was trained in jihad and Arabic, somewhere in Turkey or Beirut or Cairo or Ohio? Anyway, this is Radio Free Damascus. And welcome to Radio Free Damascus, a jumbo edition of the program today, stepping aside from the issues that we've been addressing over the past couple of programs, though we will be returning. I think it would be very worthwhile to address the presentation that I mentioned briefly in the last program by one Harry Knox on the subject, because it's, completely different arguments than what we've already heard. So we might as well cover all of them, because we're getting a lot of people contacting us and saying we really, 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 really need this information. This is what is being discussed in our society today. Today on Radio Free Damascus, we move away from the debate that took place back in, I believe, late February, February 23rd, if I recall correctly, at Trinity College in Dublin between Adnan Rashid and Jay Smith, to a debate that took place in Australia a few weeks after that, featuring our friend Abdullah Kunda. Now, Abdullah has called the program a couple times. Many of you have benefited greatly from the debate that Abdullah and I did back in October of last year at the University of New South Wales on the subject of the incarnation. Can God become man? And some of those issues are going to come up in the review of this debate as well. Now, this debate took place Wednesday, the 28th of March, 2012, at the University of Sydney. And is Jesus God? This was a Muslim versus Catholic debate. We have a Roman Catholic apologist in this particular instance, and that might come up a couple times, especially during the cross-examination or the question period. But primarily, we'll be listening to what Abdullah had to say. Now, I'm a little bit hesitant in doing this for a couple reasons. I don't want to get Abdullah into trouble by pointing out that we around here really like Abdullah Kunda. And Abdullah will come into our chat channel, and most of the folks in the chat channel know and really like Abdullah. And I don't want to get Abdullah in trouble with his own folks. that we find him to be a very pleasant young man, and one with whom we can have very interesting and spirited dialogue. But I guess it's my respect for Abdullah Kunda that is causing me to do this program, because I was taken aback by some of the things he said. Quite honestly, I did. There were a couple times, there's just no evidence of this, and I've sent him entire books filled with evidence of a couple of things he said there was no evidence for. So I think that it would be worthwhile to listen to Abdullah's presentation. I'm not going to listen to all of it, because it started off basically stating many of the things that his opponent already stated and talking about the places where we have agreements and things like that. But I want to pick up, basically, as I'm looking at it here, where am I picking up in this? If you have found, I'm not even certain where I got this. I think I got it on YouTube. It's been a while. I know I listened to it while riding Dynamite Road out to Rio Verde. I know that much. It's funny how that works, because I remember exactly along the road I was when Abdullah said certain things. So I remember that, but I think I got it from YouTube and ripped the audio from that, I think. And so I'm starting here, this says 8 minutes and 38 seconds into the presentation, which doesn't make much sense, actually, to be honest with you, because I thought the other guy went first, and he did, and he would have had more than 8 minute and 38 second statement. So I'm a little concerned that I have not queued things up correctly here, but we will find out soon enough once I hit play. We'll see if it's where I want it to be, and if not, then we will have the joyous experience of listening to me trying to find where it is I wanted to start. So let's hope the first voice you're going to hear here is actually Abdullah Kunda.
Why do we reject the incarnation? Well, the simple answer is that it makes no sense. Okay, it makes no sense. And the reason for that is that a Christian would affirm that Jesus the Messiah has a human nature and a divine nature. Okay? And as I said, that these natures are unique and that they don't mix. And I've even heard the statement, I think it's appropriated from St. Thomas Aquinas, that Jesus is divine in his divine nature and human in his human nature. Okay? Now, for us, this makes absolutely no sense. So if we start from, for example, the issue of the Messiah being in a hypostatic union, okay, so being unified with a human nature.
Now, I'm going to have to be making corrections as we go along. These are some of these things are things we discussed in our debate. And if Abdullah rejects my explanations, and I'd like to know why. Does he feel that it's an improper explanation? It's not representative of the Christian position. I really would be very, very surprised, by the way, just in passing, if the Roman Catholic apologist would disagree with most of what I'm going to be saying, in at least as far as this particular section where we're talking about the hypostatic union. He just said in his statement, what we just heard was the Messiah was united to a human nature. No, the Messiah refers to the historical person of Jesus of Nazareth. And so the term Messiah would be in reference to the person who uniquely in all of history was the God-man. And so trying to separate, I think one of Abdullah's primary problems is that he separates out the natures and titles and tries to have them exist separately from what the biblical revelation actually reveals about their relationship and the fact that we're only talking about one person here. We're not talking about two persons. We're talking about the historical person, Jesus of Nazareth, but we firmly believe that one person was not like any other person who has ever existed. That is one of the things I think that needs to be emphasized, is that the key Islamic assertion about Jesus is that he was a mere Rasul. That means he was like many other Rasuls before him. Now, there may have been, I think, and I could be wrong about this, but off the top of my head, I don't think there is any other virgin-born individual in the Quran or in Islamic theology, to my knowledge. I mean, other than obviously Adam was created, I suppose you could call that some form of virgin birth, but outside of that. So he would be unique on that level, but he is merely a man. He is a servant of Allah. He did amazing things. He did things that the Quran says he did that historically he didn't do. As part of the book that I'm writing, I just translated the portion from the infancy gospel of Thomas, where Jesus forms 12 clay birds. And he does this out of clay at the ford of a brook, and it's on the Sabbath, and a certain Jew sees him doing this, and so he goes off and tells Joseph, and Joseph comes, and he's all upset. Why have you done this on the Sabbath? And so what Jesus does is he claps his hands, and he says, "Be gone!" And the birds take wing. They become living birds, and they take off chirping. And, of course, then later on, Jesus gets mad at the people who tattled on him and strikes him blind, but the Jesus of this particular document is very, very different than the historical Jesus. But anyway, Jesus does miraculous things in the Quran. The author of the Quran does not seem to be able to differentiate between historical sources and mythical and legendary sources. But he does miraculous things, but he's not the only one who does miraculous things. So he's not unique in the way that we believe him to be unique. Sorry about that divergence there. We'll never get through all of this if I do not avoid discussing some of the things that I'm doing and writing the book right now. But it happens when you're writing a book. You tend to talk about stuff that you're talking about in the book at that particular point in time. So all of that to say, it was not the Messiah who was joined to a human nature. The Messiah is the God-man. That term would be of Jesus of Nazareth. That's an inappropriate description that Abdullah just gave.
Did this action come about through the substance of God, or did it come about through one of the individual hypostases of God?
All of the above. Once again, Abdullah insists on making divisions where divisions are not necessary. And so, saying, well, is this something that the three persons together do, or only one person does? Well, that's not really a meaningful question. Because while we can differentiate between the actions of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and it's only the Son who becomes flesh, he is sent by the Father and the Son send the Holy Spirit, we're still talking about anything that the Father does is a divine action, anything the Son does is a divine action, anything the Spirit does is a divine action. And so it's not an either-or situation as presented in that kind of an argument.
So did the Father bring it about? Did the Son bring it about himself? Did the Spirit bring it about?
You look at the resurrection. The resurrection is described as involving all three divine persons at various points in the scriptural narrative. So it's not an either-or type of situation.
If it's an action of the substance, okay, then the hypostases themselves have no creative action, and therefore their individual persona are irrelevant.
Again, based upon a false assumption previously, but that wouldn't follow anyways. How does that follow logically? How does that make them irrelevant if there is one divine action that the three persons are united in accomplishing? How does that make them irrelevant? I mean, just on a logical basis, I do not see how this follows at all.
If it is an action of the Father, say in conjunction with the Spirit, then they have a unique power that the Son does not have.
So you really need to recognize what the presuppositions that Abdullah is bringing to this argument against the incarnation really are. Here the presupposition really is that there cannot be a plurality in the Godhead, because if any one acts, not independently of the others, but in a way that is differentiatable, that is recognizable, we recognize the Father and differentiate between the Father and the Son based upon the actions. The Father loves the Son, sends the Son. The Son is the one who is sent and is loved by the Father. The Father and the Son send the Holy Spirit. From this assumption, that could never happen. Either they all have to do the same thing and then become irrelevant, or, I mean, really, there just really isn't any way, given the parameters that Abdullah is, I think, rather improperly and arbitrarily assigning to even begin to discuss the issue because it's based upon a Unitarian presupposition. I'm not sure if he's really recognized how overriding his Unitarian presupposition is.
And if it is an action of the Son, then the Son becoming the Messiah is effectively irrelevant. Okay? Now, that may not make much sense at the moment, but it will as we go on and give more examples. And here's a quote from the Quran that refutes the idea of God taking on any offspring. That isn't directed purely at Christians. It's directed at any religion that has that as a concept.
Now, of course, we didn't get really a chance to expand upon this, but I would point out that there is a big question concerning exactly what it is the Quran is condemning in regards to sonship en toto. Now, Abdullah is saying, well, that's not just about Christians, but it does seem that he's saying that it is about Christians in some sense. But clearly, the nature of sonship for Christians is absolutely unique. The deities represented in the Kaaba in the Jahiliyyah period prior to the cleansing of the Kaaba by Muhammad toward the end of his life when the Muslims take over Mecca, the deities represented there would have been numerous pairings where you had a male deity, a female deity, and offspring. Now, when the Quran, in numerous places, condemns the idea of God having a son, it very frequently, in the process, links that to the idea of God having a spouse. And even to this day, the most popular Islamic apologist of the past 50 years, and I would argue he's still the most popular Islamic apologist, though he's been dead for a number of years now, Ahmed Didat clearly believed that the Christian understanding of the relationship of father and son was a sexual understanding. That God had sons by the tons, but that what Christians were talking about was a sonship that is related to sexual procreation, which is not what Christians believe today. It is not what Christians believed at the time of Muhammad, and it is not what Christians believed prior to Muhammad. And that is why I've challenged, it looks like it may be, and that was one of the emails I needed to get to today, and I'll try to do that this evening. It may be that one of the debate topics that we will be addressing in London, again, interestingly enough, is, does the Quran misrepresent the Trinity? You say, wait a minute, didn't you just do that with Bassam Zawadi? Yes, but the folks there in London want to do it again from a different perspective. And so the question will once again be raised. Upon what basis should I, as a Christian, accept the normative theological expression of the teaching of the Quran when the Quran does not show any first-hand familiarity with what Christians believed on this subject at that time in history? Why is, if the relationship once again that is seen more than once in the Quranic text is Torah, Injil, then Quran. Quran is the final, the Muhaiman, the one that guards over there, but there is still a line there, a very special line. Moses, Torah, Jesus, Gospel, Muhammad, Quran. Why is it that you can go to books like the book of Hebrews in the New Testament and find intimate familiarity with the text of the Old Testament, numerous citations and argumentation based upon the understandings of the Jewish people at the time of the Messiahship of Jesus, but you find nothing like that, absolutely nothing like that in the Quran at all. At least try to put yourself in our position and ask yourself the question, do you really feel that the Quran's presentation is so clear and so compelling and so perfect and so mubinun that we as Christians should go, we should even see clearly our own beliefs being addressed in the Quran? Wouldn't you think the Quran would have to be very clear in its statements if it's the final revelation? Those are questions that really I think the serious Islamic apologist must give serious consideration to.
Now, we could then look at the nature of the birth of Jesus. And obviously, the true idea is that his birth was natural, however, he did not have a father. When I say true, I guess for the Christians you can translate that as the Islamic idea. The Christian idea is that he was born, and at his birth and conception, the hypostatic union came into place.
That's almost sounds like Abdullah is identifying Nestorianism as Christian orthodoxy. I don't think that he was trying to do this, but it almost sounds like he is placing the temporal happening, occurrence, point in time of the incarnation, and hence the coming into existence of the hypostatic union, since obviously the human nature has not eternally been united to God. This did take place in time. But it sounds like he's making this at the time of the birth. And the whole argument involving Nestorius, and there's all sorts of confusion as to exactly what Nestorius thought he was saying and how other people interpret him, and Cyril of Alexandria and all that stuff. Politics and everything else that had a role. But leaving that aside for the moment, it seems like what at least historically Nestorius has been understood being saying is something similar to that Mary was the mother of only the human aspect of Christ. And so you had adoptionists and others who took that even farther. And Nestorius was condemned for that, and the very term Theotokos, mother of God, was a Christological title emphasizing that that which was born of Mary, not immediately afterwards or even simultaneously, but we recognize that the child Jesus was the child Jesus in the womb, just as John the Baptist was. He leapt for joy in the womb of his mother at the presence of Mary. The hypostatic union would pre-exist the birth of Jesus in that sense. But I don't honestly know if he was even, you know, you can tell these are not written out. This Abdullah is speaking extemporaneously here. He's doing what I frequently do. It's similar to the way I do it, and that is sometimes I do write out my opening presentation if there's certain things I really need to make sure that I'm going to get to. But when we debated, I had slides, he has slides, and you're basically speaking extemporaneously on the basis of the order of the slides and material that's on the slides. So I don't know that he was actually trying to address this, but I just noticed that the Roman Catholic apologist who actually engaged in this particular debate just tweeted me. This is Jason Sabalo. And Jason, may I just say something to you, sir? On Twitter, change your pick. It's frightening, okay? I've not even watched any of those movies, and it's still frightening. Just a word to you. that's just too weird. Anyway, he just tweeted me and said, yes, if you listen to the Q&A of the debate, it sounded to me he was confusing orthodoxy with Nestorianism. I did get that feeling as well, and certainly the comments that were just made would seem to be supportive of that interpretation of what he was saying. But I'm sure that if he's even up at this time of whatever time it is in Australia, maybe really early in the morning. I forget what it is. It's 17 or 18 hours, depending on what's going on, that he'll let us know one way or the other. And I hope that everyone hears that when I do provide these corrections, just as we did before I went to Australia for our original debate, I hope he certainly hears the fact that I do so, out of fidelity to my faith and honor the Lord Jesus Christ, but B, also out of great concern for him as well, and a hope that he will accept any corrections that are necessary to be given. And if he disagrees, that we can then have discussion about that. But we continue on.
Okay. However, the issue here is that you would affirm that the Messiah is eternal, but the human nature is not.
No. The Messiah is eternal. Again, the Messiah is the historical person who was born in Bethlehem. The Son is eternal. The Messiah would be properly refer to the incarnate one. So, no.
He's not eternal. Okay. You also affirm that the Messiah is fully human and fully divine. Okay. So he's got these mutually exclusive attributes which cannot exist in the individual person.
Now, There is the presupposition. And in fact, I'm going to roll this back because, I mentioned to Abdullah, I played our debate in my Sunday school class, all of it, for my Sunday school class at Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. And we very carefully went through his statements. And fundamentally, we concluded that the reason, even though it was much more thought through and much more complex than 99% of the Muslims you'll ever talk to, that fundamentally he's still operating on the presupposition that God cannot become man because God cannot become man, period, end of discussion. It is at its base circular. So let me back this up just a second, a little bit here, and listen again to what was just said.
That you would affirm that the Messiah is eternal, but the human nature is not eternal. Okay. You also affirm that the Messiah is fully human and fully divine. Okay. So he's got these mutually exclusive attributes which cannot exist in the individual person.
So mutually exclusive attributes which cannot exist in one person. There's the presupposition. What is that fundamentally saying? There can be no incarnation. But why? It's an assertion to say that these mutually exclusive attributes. Now, what we're saying, we're not saying that he's one person with a bunch of different attributes. We're saying that he is one person, but that those attributes refer to the two natures that are his. And why is it that you say that the creator of the human nature cannot take on that human nature? Did the creator create something that was imperfect? Well, this again takes us back, and I'm not really sure this comes out as clearly in this debate as it did in ours, but a lot of this comes back to how we view human nature. And we, as Christians, believe that God created a perfect human being in Adam and the human nature that Jesus Christ took on. But from Abdullah's perspective, to be perfect is to be divine. So there can be no perfect human because there is no divine human. So every human is by nature imperfect. And therefore, the incarnation couldn't take place. But we, of course, reject the idea that to be perfect, you must be divine. To be perfectly divine, you have to be divine. Yeah. But our God has the capacity to create something that is exactly as God intends it to be creatively is therefore perfect because it fulfills the divine intention for it. That's why he can over and over again say in the creation story, it is good, it is good, it is very good. So this is a presuppositional issue that, again, I have to challenge Abdullah on, because he's allowing it to determine the outcome of his argumentation. Now, Jason has told me that it's almost 9 o'clock down there, but evidently, I'm not sure why this was going on, but he says, Abdullah and I were up past 3 this morning. So I'm not sure why, but again, it's frightening to me wearing that Jason mask, and I'm now concerned for Abdullah's safety. Islamic apologist Abdullah Kunda has disappeared, and only parts have been found. Like I said, got to change that pick, man. It's just scary.
Okay, a human being is not eternal, and you affirm that. And again, it's not conceivable that God should have begotten himself a son. Limitless is he in his glory. When he wills a thing to be, he says to it, be, and it is.
Now, it's interesting, because I do not think that the author of the Quran was arguing on the same level that Abdullah is trying to argue on. In other words, it sounds to me that Abdullah is trying to do what I have challenged Islamic apologists to do for a long time. That is step up their game. But the only way they can step up their game is to transcend the level of argumentation that's found in their own scriptures. Think about that. I don't think that that is what the author of the Quran is talking about. I think the sonship mentioned in that text is clearly the type of sonship that was prevalent amongst the gods in the Kaaba. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an eternal relationship of father and son, which would have nothing to do with the incarnation, by the way, which was just what was just being discussed. So there's a lot of category problems here. And Abdullah said in our debate, well, don't you think it's just a little bit convenient that you keep sort of making excuses here? Well, could it just be, Abdullah, that your revelation does not provide you with sufficient depth and breadth of categories to address the very revelation that your revelation says is wrong? Well, I guess, actually, let me take that back. I want to be accurate in my statement. I don't think the Quran says that our revelation is wrong. The Quran says that what we've done with the revelation is wrong. Ta'alu, it's a excess. We have gone into excess. So I want to correct that. But your revelation still does not provide you with the breadth and depth of categories to address the Christian faith that your revelation at the time of its giving says leads to hellfire. Which means this is a rather important and weighty subject.
What about the death of the Messiah? Well, we have a pretty easy get-out clause. We say that the Messiah didn't die, that he's being rescued into heaven.
By the way, it does look... I'm not sure how we're going to do this yet. We're still talking about it, and like I said, I owe the folks in London an email. But I really, 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 really want to get an Islamic apologist who will defend Surah 4:157 and will defend the denial of the crucifixion of Christ. It might happen this trip. Let's just say we're hoping to work that out.
Now, the problem with the Christian idea here is that if the Messiah had to die to bring about the salvation of humanity, then when you say Messiah, you mean the human nature and the divine nature.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we've said all along and corrected earlier.
Okay. But how could a divine nature die?
What's death? This is we can't keep having to address this, but I'm surprised that Muslims keep bringing this up, because Muslims are not annihilationists. They don't believe that you cease to exist when you die. And so if we're not talking about the divine nature dying in the sense of ceasing to exist. We're talking about the one person giving the real life that's his. You admit that even despite the virgin birth, which you accept, Jesus was a real person, and therefore he had a real life, in fact, a life that was not under the curse of sin, because he did not sin, and therefore could voluntarily and freely give his life. And so it was the one person who gave that life, that perfect, sinless life. Doesn't mean he ceased to exist in either his human nature or is in his divine nature. It's not annihilation. It's not cessation of existence. It is voluntary giving of life, which is exactly what happens in regards to Jesus' sacrifice upon the cross of Calvary. A perfect life in behalf of all those who need to have a perfect life but don't have it.
Right, what exactly does that mean? If you want to say, no, it was just the human nature, then the Messiah didn't die. Okay, the human nature did, but the divine nature didn't, and therefore the Messiah was actually alive in one nature.
Okay. Well, again, this it is inappropriate to, at one point, divide things up, and at other points, cram them together, and not allow the terms to have the same meaning throughout the conversation. We're talking about one person, Jesus. And you don't ask, you know, when Muhammad died, you don't ask, did he die in his prophethood? Did the prophethood of Muhammad die? Can prophethood die? I mean, there's all sorts of odd categorical things that you can bring up that don't really address the issue, I think. And I think that's what's going on here.
Okay. The other question then to ask would be, if the divine nature did die, okay, so the Messiah as a whole died, human nature and divine nature, well then how could the substance of God exist without one of his essential personalities?
Assumption being that death is annihilation, which I just... Abdullah knows that's not an Islamic presupposition and that's not a Christian belief either. So why is the idea being insisted upon here that death means cessation of existence? I don't understand it. It's not. Therefore, it's not really an objection.
Therefore, that would say that that personality isn't essential. Okay. Now, the point that I'm getting at through all of this in simple terms is...
Now, let me just stop and just point out, there really hasn't yet been a weighty objection. There's been a lot of confusion on Abdullah's part regarding the nature of incarnation and things like that, based, I think, upon an anachronistic reading backwards into the text, presuppositions that are not actually there. But there really hasn't been an argument at this point against what it is we believe on the topic.
Is that ultimately we come to a stopgap where the conclusion that you have indicates some deficiency in God. And straight away, we would say that that can't be God.
Some deficiency in God. Now, this again came up in our debate. And it really is just the restatement in much more in-depth terminology. But it's still just the restatement of God cannot become a man. God does not have the capacity to join to himself a perfect human nature without ceasing to be God. To which I again say, why? If God could create that nature, if it was his desire and his will to do so, if this was the means by which he chose to bring about his greatest glory, the greatest demonstration of the attributes of God, why can he not do that? He is not becoming imperfect because the divine nature is not changing. The divine nature is not becoming temporal. The divine nature is not becoming weak or ignorant or any of these things. That would be a violation of the hypostatic union, which Abdullah is one of the few Muslims that can actually enunciate that belief intelligently. And yet, if he would understand what it means, that his argumentation is he's violating the very definition that he's announced, because he is saying there's an intermixture so that the divine can become temporal or the human can become eternal, I guess. It's just that the argumentation itself is not consistent with what Abdullah does give evidence of already knowing.
Whatever is deficient cannot be God. So even if we were to take your idea on board and say, yes, God is divided, not divided, pardon me, but it has three personalities, and...
Oh, the personalities, that's playing with modalism there.
The Son took on human form, and as the Messiah, he died on the cross for us in human and divine nature. We would then say, well, the Son is irrelevant, so we won't worship the Son. We'd only worship the Spirit and the Father.
So when he says irrelevant, what he means by that is if there is anything that he considers to be imperfect, that is creaturely. And hence, if there's an incarnation, then I'm not going to worship the incarnate one. But that's just an arbitrary statement. It's not an argument against the reality that that's A, what the scriptures teach, and B, exactly what God did in Jesus Christ.
Okay, unless God has those attributes that we spoke about, we don't consider him to be God.
Which Jesus did. The problem here is that Abdullah will not allow for the A, continued exercise of all divine attributes by the Father and the Spirit, the sustaining of the universe, etc., etc., and B, the temporary, purposeful, and voluntary self-limitation of certain divine attributes on the part of the Son for the purpose of the accomplishment of the intention of the incarnation. In other words, the argument in essence is that God does not have the freedom, that God is forced to exercise in fullness every attribute at all times. So if God is glorious, he cannot veil his glory for any particular period of time, even if it was appropriate for him to do so to accomplish his intents and purposes. That is not within the freedom of God from the way that Abdullah is arguing. Okay? I hope you're following here. I know this is pretty in-depth stuff, and I know that 99% of the Muslims you're talking to aren't going here, but my thinking is, if you think through the incarnation on this level, then you will be able to more clearly explain it to someone who does have questions about it. And folks, remember something? It's we're coming up on the second year anniversary now of my posting of that video asking Norman Geisler those questions. 2 years. Can you believe it? 2 years coming up in July. And we all remember that during the Kanner scandal, which is ongoing, it's sort of like the Korean War. It's not really over. but during the Kanner scandal, we played one of these encounters that Kanner had at Liberty. And this time with a poorly educated Oneness Pentecostal associate pastor. And remember, Kanner did a faceplant in defining the sonship of God in the incarnation. So here you've got somebody, an allegedly former Muslim, who could not even begin to critique what Abdullah is saying here. Could not even try. Because he does not possess a meaningful theological vocabulary and understanding of the key issues relevant to the nature of sonship and the incarnation itself. So, I think that as Christians, we need to be challenged to know what we believe on this issue. And this is an excellent opportunity for you as a believer. Yeah, it takes a little extra brain power. It's not nearly as fun as listening to some other podcast you could be listening to right now. And we've already probably had a bunch of people click us off. Because, this is a tough subject. You're talking about complicated things. But to answer the things that Abdullah is saying requires you to know the truth. And this is an area of great weakness on the part of many Christians. Let's face it. When was the last time you ever heard a sermon that would have gone in depth enough to have equipped you to have responded to Abdullah Kunda? It just hardly ever happens. Maybe in a Bible study in really good churches, but they're few and far between. In fact, I would say that the number of seminary graduates who are pastors who can engage this in a meaningful fashion, small minority. And we're reaping the results of that. So just a brief encouragement to my fellow believers to press on with me here and understand why we take the time to do these kinds of things. It is very, very important.
And again, there's a quote from the Quran refuting the crucifixion. And again, the same.
Now, I just want to mention. here's a quote from the Quran refuting the crucifixion. No, this quote from the only quote from the Quran is Surah 4:17, which I'm sure is what's up on the screen right now. But that doesn't refute the crucifixion. It's just simply a denial. Denial and refutation are not the same thing. Refutation would involve the provision of a basis upon which you could actually believe what it's saying. It's just a denial. I can deny that Muhammad is a prophet. That's not a refutation of the prophet of Muhammad, is it? I don't think that it is.
The same problem comes up with the resurrection. How did the resurrection come about? Did the Son do it himself? If that's the case, then the Father and Spirit weren't necessary in the plan for salvation.
No. Even if, let's just grant for a moment, because this isn't the case. In fact, this is the very example I used earlier. The Bible involves Father, Son, and Spirit in the resurrection, creation accounts, etc., etc. But let's just grant for a moment. Let's just say, theoretically, that the Bible said that there was a Son alone. I have authority to take it up again. All right? Would that make the other persons irrelevant? No, it would not. It would just simply affirm the freedom of God to act as he chooses to act. And if there are three divine persons, and those three divine persons choose to act in such a way that one divine person does a particular act, how is that a denial of anything? It sounds like what Abdullah is insisting upon is a set of arguments that, again, just simply preclude the possibility of Trinitarianism or anything else just by divine fiat, just saying, well, it has to be this way. But you have to ask, well, why is that? Why do you say that? What's the basis of that? And he hasn't given us a basis for that.
Did the Son need to rely on the Father and the Spirit? Okay, if that's the case, well, then the Son's reliant. And again, we would not worship him.
But the Messiah is reliant. And why could not the Son have the freedom to choose to rely upon the Father and the Spirit? See, again, the argument is, every divine person must exercise every divine attribute at all times. There can be no cooperation. There can be no distinctions. There can be nothing in the Godhead that would reveal to us what the Father does, the Spirit does, the Son does, anything like that. But we've been given no basis upon which to accept that assertion.
Okay, because he must be self-subsistent. And if it was the substance of God itself...
But even if he's self-subsistent, how does that deny him his freedom to act as he chooses to act? Why is the Son being self-sufficient? Why does that not, or why does that substantiate the assertion that he could not be reliant upon the Father to do something? We've not been given that explanation.
Without any involvement from the individual personalities, then they are not necessary. And again, we would say that we would worship God. O men, it is you who stand in need of God, whereas he alone is beyond needing the assistance of others, the one to whom all praise is due.
Again, I appreciate the fact that Abdullah is providing Quranic citations, but are they really relevant to what he's saying? I mean, in a sort of general way, you could make some connection, but is that really what the original text was about? I don't have any reason for believing the author of the Quran had nearly as much knowledge of the Christian doctrine of the Trinity as Abdullah Kunda does. And that's saying a lot, given the Islamic view of what the Quran is, which, of course, is one of the very reasons I cannot accept the Quranic view of what the Quran allegedly is.
So, ultimately, there are a couple of questions I think that Christians need to ask themselves. The first one is, can you really say Jesus is Lord? Well, you can, but you need to also affirm the rest of what you affirm.
Can we say Jesus is Lord? What do we mean when we say that? Well, kurios is a highly exalted term. And as I explained in our debate, one of the key texts is found in Scripture where the Apostle Paul says if the rulers of this age had known, understood, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory or the glorious Lord. So the term Lord there is used. We know kurios has the most exalted meanings, especially when joined with the term glorious. And yet it's here referring to the Messiah, the incarnate one, because he was the one who was crucified. And so one exalted divine title used of the incarnate one. This is one of the chief reasons why we believe it is biblical and appropriate in light of revelational categories to recognize and insist upon the hypostatic union, because the Apostle Paul is willing to use language on this level.
You need to say he's Lord and servant.
Yes, he is Lord and he is servant. He is king, he is high priest, he is prophet, he is servant, he is suffering servant, he is Messiah. Part of the problem is that our Muslim friends are forced by the categories not only of the Quran but of later developed Islamic orthodoxy to limit Jesus, and hence to identify this fullness of revelation of Jesus found in the New Testament documents as excess, going beyond the bounds. But that's because they look back upon these documents through the lens of the Quran rather than reading those documents as they would have spoken to the original audiences.
He's God and man. Okay? He's eternal and temporal. He's independent and dependent. Okay, you can't just say one or the other. Because if you say one, if you just say Jesus is Lord, eternal, independent, then that's just the same as us saying he's temporal, dependent, and man. You see what I mean? Unless you're affirming exactly what you affirm, then there's no point to it.
I'm really not sure what the objection here is. I mean, Christian orthodoxy is very, very clear in affirming these very issues. I mean, and I've been very clear in affirming the full humanity and the full deity of Christ without mixing them together, without violating the hypostatic union. So I'm really not sure exactly what the argument is, unless it's just simply a restatement of, and I just don't believe God would do this.
So you would have to say, if you're not saying both of these attributes simultaneously, that he's a man, servant of God, temporal and subordinate creation, and indeed that's the true position. What about as the Messiah with the divine and the human natures? Did he ever perform an action? Did the Messiah ever perform an action? So for example, in the Gospel according to Mark, when Jesus is quoted as saying that no one knows the hour, not even the Son, who's speaking there? It can't be the divine nature, because if he was divine, he would know.
Unless, of course, once again, as we have explained numerous times before, unless, of course, we shouldn't ask the question, who's speaking here, as if different natures can speak. I mean, Jesus can say things about himself. For example, when he speaks of his eternal preexistence, he's not talking about his flesh. When he says, before Abraham was, I am, he's not saying that his flesh was before Abraham. So there can be contexts in John 17, for example, where he specifically makes reference to the time before the creation of the world when, in the presence of the Father, he shared the very glory of Yahweh, because he is Yahweh. Okay, he's not talking about the human flesh at that point. All right, that's understandable. But when he's talking in Matthew and in Mark about the knowledge of that hour, once again, we're referring to those self-limitations that make the incarnation both viable, meaningful, and which make it fitting in the divine economy. So it would not have been fitting for the Messiah to have demonstrated and given evidence of the fullness of the divine glory in the Messiah. If Jesus walked down the street with the brightness of pure light, that would not have allowed the interactions and teaching and ministry that God intended for the Messiah. the Messiah needed to be surrounded by the hurting and the rejected of the people so that the conversations could take place that exposed the religious hypocrisy of the Pharisees. If the divine attribute of blindingly bright white purity and glory were to be manifested in the life of the Messiah in its fullness, then he could not have accomplished the things that God had intended for him to accomplish. And so there was a self-veiling of that glory for the accomplishment of those purposes. And the same way, there was a veiling of the knowledge of this particular aspect of God's plan. I believe it was temporary. It was only for the period of time of the incarnation. But I would again say to Abdullah, are you really consistent in raising this argument, or are you just using arguments that other Islamic apologists before you have used? Because you don't believe Jesus would ever have said this, because he's calling himself the Son here. So are you being consistent? Do you believe Jesus said these words? Did he say the Son? If you say he didn't say the Son, if you say he did say this, then please explain what it is he's actually communicating, because he's placing himself here above the angels. No man knows, neither the angels in heaven, nor the Son. It's a clear progression. The Son is associated here with the Father. He uses the very language of Father and Son here, the very language that the Quran says Jesus never used. In fact, seems to directly reject in Surah 5:116. So are you being consistent to even see this as representation of Jesus?
So that must have only been the human nature speaking at that time. Okay, when he got hungry, as is reported in the Gospels, and he ate, that could not have been the divine nature. Okay.
Well, the divine nature, natures don't eat. I wouldn't even say human nature eats. Humans eat. So the Messiah, as a man, ate. Because if you don't eat, you're not actually human. But what is the fundamental objection here? Again, it all goes back to, well, God doesn't have the freedom to do this. And we continue to ask the question, why not?
But when he says things like, I and the Father are one, that cannot be the human nature. Okay, because the Father doesn't have a human nature.
Why not? What are you understanding? I and the Father and one are one to mean? The Messiah says that I and the Father are one, and he's referring to himself, yes, as the Son here, but the Messiah is speaking. I and the Father are one in bringing about the redemption of God's people. Why cannot the incarnate one say that? We're not told why. It just seemingly is assumed that that is an impossibility.
It can only be the divine nature. So what exactly did this Messiah, who was made up of two natures, do? He didn't do anything.
He did everything that we've already mentioned. It is this very attempting to divide things up that is the problem that Abdullah has.
The divine nature did some things, the human nature did some things, but the Messiah as a whole did nothing. And that's just summarizing those. We then need to go on and ask other questions. If we're going to say he's fully man, well then could he have got married? Could he have fathered a child?
Yeah. If that was God's intention. I mean, if he's fully man, that's why he had to eat. That's why he slept. No one denies that, but it was not his intention to do so. And even going any farther down that road is ridiculous because it didn't happen. So it becomes purely speculative and not really worthy of pursuing, but yeah.
Okay, they're attributes of someone being fully human. And if he could have fathered a child, well, then he could have been a father himself.
In the context of that, yeah, but that's totally irrelevant to the use of Father of Jesus, because that's a relationship that is non-sexual and eternal. Completely different context.
So he'd be a son and a father.
He'd be the son and a father. But again, completely different context.
Okay. Again, these are questions that you need to answer. We don't need to answer.
I don't think so. They're purely speculative and beyond what we claim to be divine revelation. We are asserting that he was truly man. That the incarnation really took place. And so far we haven't heard any objection to that outside of, well, that can't happen because anything that's not divine is imperfect, which we don't have any reason for accepting.
Answer them, okay, because we don't affirm these sorts of attributes.
No, and you don't affirm the freedom of Allah to engage in certain activities, which do not involve the change of the divine nature, because God has not ceased to be eternal, God has not ceased to be self-existent, or any of these things. You just deny that God can enter into his own creation to bring about his own glory.
And that's the quote that we went through at the beginning, saying that those who affirm this idea that Jesus is God are denying the truth. And look, it's fine to question. Sorry, is that the end? Or is that...
No, 2 minutes ago.
2 minutes ago, thank you. It's fine to question. Okay.
See, it's just one of my little things, and I've said it so many times before, but why is it that I seem to be the only person who does debates that buys a timer? Why am I the only one with a countdown timer in front of me? How many times have you heard me have to correct the moderator? Because the moderator didn't get the time right. I don't get it. It's like Jerry Mattox. How many times have I had to allow Jerry Mattox to borrow my timer? Well, that's because Jerry Mattox is so completely disorganized that even if he bought one, he'd never find it for the second time. He'd lose it. There's no question. It'd be buried under the piles of papers under his desk. So I guess I can understand that. But with Shabir up at the mosque in Toronto, what was I doing? I was having to hand him timers. I was having to get timers out for myself. I just don't get it. These people engage in so many debates. How many debates has Abdullah now done? And he still doesn't seem to have a timer for himself. I don't
get it. Okay, and the Quran wants you to question. It doesn't want you to just take what I say on face value. But
Yeah, Jerry Mattox's dog would eat it. That's true.
You do need to think about evidence. What evidence can you use? Okay, and sometimes you'll ask questions like, well, how can God be relational? How can he love if he didn't exist in the Trinity? In eternity, you know, how can he be all just and all merciful if he didn't have this plan?
Well, okay, it is a historic Christian argument, definitely developed more fully by Augustine in his On the Trinity, but it's I think pre-exists that, and certainly developed much more during the medieval period. How can a Unitarian God be love for eternity, since there would be no object of his love? And I think that's a worthwhile discussion. I think it'd be something to talk about over, you know, dinner with Abdullah or something like that. But I don't see it as a primary biblical argument. And I sort of like sticking with biblical argumentation more than anything else.
Well, these are questions that you ask from a created mindset, trying to constrict an uncreated God into a created box.
Trying to constrict an uncreated God into a created box. Well, I'm not sure how asking about eternity past, I'm not sure why does that have anything to do with creation? Unless what he's saying is that love is not actually an eternal attribute of Allah. But if you're asserting that it is, then I think it's fair to ask the question, how was love expressed by Allah prior to the creation of any object of love? I think it's fair. I'm not sure how that's trying to force him into a created box. I mean, could we not fairly ask the question in light of some of the things that Abdullah himself asks, did God become loving only at creation? And does that not involve a change in the nature of Allah? I mean, in light of some of the questions that he himself asks of us.
To add to that, you could then present some ideas like, well, Jesus claimed to be God, so he's either Lord, liar, or lunatic. And I'd say, well, no, he could be legend, labelled, or laconic to the point of being misunderstood. See, this is a fallacy that not even alliteration can protect. Right? It doesn't need to be those three options, Lord, liar, lunatic. There's many other options, you know.
I'm not really sure what these other options would be. I guess what he's saying is, well, Lord, liar, lunatic all depends upon the accuracy of the representations made by the apostles in the scriptures. I suppose that's one, that would be the essence, I think, of what he's trying to bring out there.
You know, only limited by my poor vocabulary, basically. What about the Gospels?
Now, here's where I'll have to admit, I really felt this was not something, I guess maybe he had done it at other points in the past, but this was not something I expected from Abdullah. It's something I do expect from most Islamic apologists, but I didn't expect it from him. The topic is pretty straightforward. And you're right at the end of your time. You have less than 2 minutes left, maybe 90 seconds. And so the last 90 seconds is the standard scattergun, shotgun approach. It's let's throw out a bucket load of stuff here. And normally this is done by someone who's trying to, well, we're in the political season here in the United States, solidify the base. Get your the people on your side excited before the next guy can get back up. And there's no way you can answer all these things, because what you're doing is you're bringing up all sorts of different topics that actually aren't a part of the debate itself. So let's start throwing out stuff about the Gospels and alleged contradictions and, you know, throw a few more things out there like that. And there's no way to, you can't meaningfully even make the point. You can't provide enough reasonable substantiation of it for it even to be meaningful in your presentation of it. And certainly the other guy, who now has half the amount of time or even less than he had his opening presentation, is not going to have the time to meaningfully engage it. It's sort of like what Roman Catholics always do. Sorry to the Roman Catholic fellow who is doing the debate here, but it is beyond all question that there was a meeting in the headquarters of Catholic Answers somewhere in the late 80s or early 90s where they wrote up, here's how you do debates. And one of the things they said is, always make sure to throw out some argument about sola scriptura or the canon in any debate you do, and make sure to do it late enough in the debate that the Protestant does not have even a ghost of a chance of making any meaningful response to it. And that's the way you can get your people all riled up. Like, oh, yeah, got him on that one. Especially if you're not winning the debate. If you're not winning the debate, throw out the canon and sola scriptura as that which is going to get your people all revved up. And that seems to be sort of what the Muslims do when they start throwing this kind of stuff out. And that's not how you do debates. That's not how you at least honor the debate process. And I don't think it's showing much respect either for your opponent or for your audience. And so now I've just said something against both people in this debate. But I just did not understand why he did this.
The gospel accounts, are they genuinely reliable in presenting this idea? In Mark's gospel, Jesus is referred to always as rabbi. In Matthew's gospel...
No, he's not always referred to as rabbi. I mean, when you say referred to, by whom? I mean, he calls himself Son of Man. So, not just rabbi. So I guess the better way would have said, well, other people refer to him, but the disciples didn't only use that. So this is the old Shabir Ali evolution argument here, which really collapses upon examination. Especially when you have the same Mark and Gospel being the one where Jesus so clearly, when he is demanded by the high priest to identify himself, identifies himself using the very language of Daniel 7, where you have a divine person in heavenly vision. And very clear, yes, I am the Son of the Blessed One. Yeah, that's me. And yet, well, he's just rabbi. No, that's not an accurate handling of the Gospel of Mark. But again, his opponent, how's he supposed to explain all these things when you're given one half or one third or even one quarter of the amount of time? Generally, you just have to let them go, which is unfortunate, because it allows your opponent to sort of accomplish what it is he's trying to accomplish, and that is to keep his base in the dark.
Gospel, he's referred to as Lord. Okay? In Mark's Gospel, when the writer is referring to Jesus calming the sea of Galilee, the disciples say, "Do you not care that we are going to die?" Okay? And they call him Rabbi.
So what are you doing here? You're in a debate on the subject of the incarnation, in essence, is Jesus God. And now what you're doing is you're going into synoptic parallel issues. I think synoptic parallel issues are interesting and relevant, which is one of the reasons that I'm doing a whole section in the book on Quranic parallel issues and how the Quran uses different language and different ways of saying things, and different words, and different verbs, and different orders. And in Surah 7, it'll say one thing, and Surah 38, it'll say another thing, while narrating the exact same events. And I point out there's an explanation from the Christian perspective when the synoptic gospels have differences. Each of the synoptic writers has different audiences, and you can use different language, and since when you're writing to different audiences, you're going to emphasize different things. And Mark normally gives a longer version, and Matthew telescopes things. And I even gave the exact example that Shabir Ali brought up in our debate in May of 2006 at Biola. But then, why are you looking at me oddly like that? Oh, okay. You looked at me like I was confusing you. Oh, you're listening. Okay. But you were multitasking, and that's why. Yeah. So anyways, I brought up that issue. And then I go into a number of Quranic texts where you have the same story told in different ways. But you can't say that you have a different author writing to a different audience. You can't say, well, Mark is clearly emphasizing this and Matthew is writing to a Jewish audience, so he emphasizes these things. But according to the Muslim, you can't even ask questions about, well, you know, when Muhammad was writing Surah 7, he had this audience in mind. But in Surah 38, he has this audience in mind. Now, historically, from any critical perspective, that's what you'd have to do. You'd have to, for example, say, well, is this a Meccan Surah? Is this a Medinan Surah? Is Muhammad dealing with this issue at this time? Is this the major issue in his mind at this time because it's later on? Now he's in Medina. You're having to deal with the Meccan attacks. I mean, that's what critical scholarship does. But the Islamic world says, don't even go there. Don't even go there, because none of this has anything to do with Muhammad at all. It's irrelevant what Muhammad was going through. He's just an actor. And so how do you explain? Why is it? When Allah narrates the fall of Iblis in one surah, and I don't have this stuff in front of me, but off the top of my head, I believe surahs 7 and 38 are the two primary ones that I use to contrast each other. But I could be wrong about that. Like I said, I'm just going off the top of my head here. But when the Quran narrates the fall of Iblis, and Allah is the one who's narrating this, is this not a perfect narration? So if you skip details or add details in another surah, which one's the perfect one? Why would there be differences? I can understand on a human level, and I could even understand if you applied a Christian concept of inspiration to the Quran, but the Quran, the Islamic community has rejected that. And in fact, I would argue the Islamic understanding of inspiration, because it is so mechanical, is significantly inferior significantly inferior to the Christian understanding of inspiration. And the vast majority of Muslims think it's just the other way around. They go, well, you guys don't have the word of God there. Paul says, bring the parchment and the cloak when you come, and that can't be the word of God. And because they have a dictation theory of inspiration, you know, Muhammad just, you know, starts sweating and he becomes quiet, and then when it's over, he recites. That's it. I mean, the whole Quran is sent down the night of Qadr, Laylat al-Qadr, night of power, and then it's piecemeal revealed to him over the next number of years by the angel Jibril. And that supposedly is this is the way to do it. You don't have all those questions you have with the Bible. Actually, it raises lots of questions. I just don't find a lot of Muslims that are asking the questions because many of them are afraid to ask the questions. That's one of the problems. So anyways, I would point out, therefore, that in raising synoptic parallel issues, and especially when you say, well, it's in Mark or it's in Matthew, no one can look this up. No one has the time in a debate to check what the references are to make sure that what you're saying is accurate. You don't put it up on the screen so that people can compare them. Maybe he did. I didn't look at the video. I suppose I need to look at the video. Maybe he did throw it up there. It doesn't sound like you did, though, from the way that you're speaking.
In the same story in Matthew, they say, we are going to die without you, Lord. Yeah, these are implying pretty different things.
Why are they implying different things? And are you consistent in recognition that... another one of the examples I used was that when the Quran, in a number of different surahs, narrates the angels coming to visit Lot in Sodom. Major differences. Major differences in this very way. In the very same thing you're seeing between Matthew and Mark, you have variations in the Quran. So it is inconsistent for a Muslim to be even raising this issue unless you explain why there are differences in the Quran and why it's a problem for me, but it's not a problem for you. But from the Christian perspective, why is the use of different terminology, since we don't believe, why would we have four Gospels if they're only supposed to be carbon copies of the other? Why would we bother? So are you saying that because Kurios appears there? Very, very careful here. Remember, Shabir Ali got himself in a little bit of trouble when he didn't check the original languages. But are you saying that the presence of Lord here means something? It sounds like what he's saying is, well, why isn't it in Mark? So I guess there's what's behind this is the standard evolutionary argument. Mark has low Christology, stuff like that, which we've already demonstrated is not the case of Mark. So are you having is Abdullah really seriously interacting with the Mark and material here or not is really the question I would ask. And why do this in 90 seconds?
Why is it that only John's gospel has the I am statements?
Good question. Why is it that only the Johannine material contains the I am statements? And that's actually what I have up on screens in front of me because obviously I thought I'd get farther than I did. And we're actually coming close to finishing our first 90 minutes and we've only done... Wow, now it says it's 42 minutes into it. Well, that was weird. You know why? No. I didn't cover all that. I just realized why my timer on this said 8 minutes. And I was worried at the beginning. That was this program, until you hit play, gives you the time index of the last thing you played. And that was one of the things from the last program. That's why it said that. Okay. So we've only played, I'd say, somewhere around, I don't know. We not a whole lot. Why was I even bringing that up? But I thought I'd get through it a lot faster and would get to the I am sayings because he's going to make some statements, and I'm not sure if it's in this opening statement or if it's in the other one, if it's in the rebuttal period. But we're going to go back through some of the material, not all of it, don't freak out, but we're going to go back through some of the material that I presented, and I'm just going to let Abdullah know if he wants to look at this. I'll gladly send him the link to this. But if you'll go back to November 29th of last year, November 29th, 2011, the title of the blog article is Reference Materials to the Dividing Line of November 29th, 2011. And you may recall, I think that dividing line was a mega size, 2-hour one, if I recall correctly. I could be wrong, but I think it was. And I was responding to various things from my debate with Patrick Navas and also some follow-up from others in regards to the debate that took place at that particular point in time. And specifically, I'm going to be looking at Section E of that material because that's where I addressed... I'm told that it's in the rebuttal period by his opponent, in fact. But I'm going to be addressing the biblical evidence because at some point basically said there just isn't any biblical evidence for this, and he's just wrong. He's just obviously didn't listen to my debate on that subject and did not look at this documentation. But Abdullah, you can find it, November 29th, 2011, Section E of the material that is provided there will be the foundation. And Abdullah should find this especially interesting because Abdullah has made numerous comments regarding the Greek Septuagint and the Hebrew Old Testament. And so the material that you'll find there in regards to Anahu and Ego Eimi, and even the repeated use of Ego Eimi, for example, at Isaiah 43:25, should be of great interest to you, and actually you should be able to process this information and utilize this information. It should be helpful to you. So Section E, November 29th, 2011, dividing line, I'm sorry, blog article. And if you want to listen, would that link still work for that dividing line? That'd still be up. So I would highly recommend to Abdullah to listen to the dividing line for that day because I will go into more depth than I'll be able to go into at this point on that particular issue, and hence we'll demonstrate that some of the comments that were made on this subject by Abdullah Kunda do not stand up to scholarly examination, shall we say. But anyway.
Which I don't think are really that clear anyway, but I'll talk about that in my rebuttal.
Ah, there you go. Which I don't think are all that clear anyway. Okay. Let's find out. Let's go in depth. Let's analyze it.
Why is it that the gospel accounts that I just spoke about the calming of the Sea of Galilee, refer to Jesus then landing at Gadara or Gerasa?
Now, there is any meaningful critical commentary on the Gospel of Mark, especially that's the primary one that I've focused upon in preaching through this section, will have a rather full discussion of the use of place names, and especially in regards to Gerasa, Gadara, and the region of the Gadareans in its material. And as a result, that raises, and if you're not familiar with what we're talking about here, there are differences in the Synoptic Gospels as to the place names that some will use, which again shows me the historical reality. That these documents were actually written by people in that time in that time period at that time because they would have used different terms. There are people who will say that Arizona State University is in Phoenix. It's not. It's in Tempe. But Tempe, of course, they will say, well, you have to fly to Phoenix. You know, the Arizona Cardinals used to play in the stadium at Arizona State University, Sun Devil Stadium. And people would say, well, we're going to Phoenix for the football game. No, you weren't. Well, yes, you were. You had to fly into Sky Harbor International Airport, which is right on the border between Phoenix and Tempe. But it's a Phoenix airport. But the football game would be in Tempe. And sometimes people would say Tempe, and sometimes they'd say Phoenix. But even today, people will say, well, I'm going to Phoenix. The Super Bowl is going to be held in Phoenix. No, it's not. It's in Glendale. The new stadium isn't in Phoenix. It's in Glendale. So, yeah, and it's the Arizona Cardinals instead of the Phoenix. You know, so we can give plenty of examples where that kind of terminology is used, and no one would accuse you of lying or being ignorant or anything else, because we recognize that when it comes to place names, geographical locations, you have areas, you have cities that the area around the city would be identified by their name, even if it was not the city itself. All sorts of issues like that come up. And that is part and parcel of the discussion of this. And there is also some rather interesting textual variants, because later generations, and really not just in that early time period, but much later generations, struggle with the same issues, and therefore their textual variants in regards to place names, when there are differences between the Synoptic Gospels, because of those very same concerns. And so it is something that is very thoroughly discussed. But how is this overly relevant, again, to this particular issue? At least we can examine the textual information regarding textual variants and things like that. How many textual variants exist in the Quran that we don't even know about because of what Uthman did? Or because of the fact we don't possess a truly critical edition of the text of the Quran? Those are also issues that I think should be brought up.
Both locations, which are over 20 kilometers away from the Sea of Galilee. What makes them any more reliable than a Harry Potter novel?
What makes them any more reliable than a Harry Potter novel? Now, I don't know where on earth that came from, because Harry Potter does not make any claims to being historical. But one simple answer to that is the very Gospels we're talking about, Abdullah, utilize place names and surnames of individuals consistently that could never be done by someone writing only 100 years later in a different locale. There you go. There's an answer. Why is there a difference? These documents give direct firsthand evidence of actually having been written at that time, in that culture, in that context, which, of course, no Harry Potter novel ever could. So we will continue, maybe not necessarily in the next dividing line, but we will continue with our examination of Abdullah Kunda's comments and response thereto here on Radio Free Damascus. But I have a feeling probably in the next program, it would be good to review the comments of one Harry Knox in his debate with Michael Brown from 2008. By the way, it's not going to be very long. We're going to have Michael Brown on this program when he tells me what his schedule. He's got a hard schedule he has to follow. We're going to make our schedule fit his. We're going to be talking about his new book, The Real Kosher Jesus. We're also going to be talking about Isaiah 53 and its testimony to Messiahship of Jesus. All coming up in the Dividing Line next couple of weeks. See you then.
I believe we're standing at the crossroads. Can't let this moment slip away. We must contend for the faith the fathers fought for. We need a new Reformation.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.